As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. Gareth Southgate's team have booked their ticket to the Euros in Germany next summer. England expect, and maybe with good reason this time, right? We'll be discussing England's chances, plus the magnificent Jude Bellingham. We'll be taking a look at the sad story of Jadon Sancho's exile at Manchester United and TV's growing threat to the 3pm blackout. I'm Gregor Robertson, and here with me to discuss all of that are Martin Samuel, Tony Cascarino and James Gearbrandt. England registered their first home win against Italy since 1977 with two goals for Harry Kane and another from Marcus Rashford. They secured qualification with two games to spare. Martin, you were there.
Yep.
And you wrote afterwards that we shouldn't be scared to admit England could win Euro 2024.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's about as far as I would go. I wouldn't say England are going to win the European Championships, but we shouldn't be scared to talk as if we should or could. I feel the same about Arsenal and the league this season, going into the league title race. We shouldn't be scared to say this could be our year. We've spent £200 million. I feel the same about England. Shouldn't be scared to say we have got a chance here, because we've got generational talents in key parts of the team, and there's some big flaws as well. There's some parts of it that need to be addressed, but every team in Europe would want to have a striker like Harry Kane. Every team in Europe would want to have Jude Bellingham, and then I think there's a few other positions in which you look at guys like Declan Rice, in which you look at guys like Kyle Walker, and think every team in Europe would like to have a player of that calibre at their disposal. So, and that was a team without Bukayo Saka as well, who's key to it. Phil Foden can't always get in, and we thought Phil Foden was a generational talent a couple of years ago. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of reasons to be positive about this England team. Doesn't mean you're going to win it, but it doesn't mean that we should go in. I think there's a little bit of negativity about England sometimes, because it's disappointed in the past, and we always get that feeling, oh, we build them up and then it's disappointing. But that doesn't mean you can't be optimistic. It doesn't mean you should stop dreaming about things.
You wrote that this is the best England team since the golden generation of 2004. What's different about the kind of atmosphere, and what's different? What gives England a better chance?
Well, I think Southgate's made a difference in that respect. I really do. I think he has given the team a purpose and a confidence that maybe it lacked before. Doesn't get you through a penalty shootout and a home final, as we discovered, because, you know, things happen. But I think generally players like playing for him, players like being in and around England, the England camp now, which they didn't always used to like. Personally, I think the 2004 team was better. I really do. I don't think that had the same weaknesses, actually, that that we find with this team. Certainly, like the centre half position, we were sport for choice if you go back to 2004, which we're not at the moment. I haven't seen an England team that you'd feel as excited about as this one for a long time. And in Bellingham, I think, is the first time since coming out of the 1990 World Cup with Paul Gascoigne where you could look at that and think, we might have the best player in the world here at the moment. We might have the most influential player in the world. You know, if not now, going to be at some stage. I mean, he's an incredible talent.
Do you agree with that, Tony?
Yeah, I agree with a lot of Martin said there, yeah. I mean, I'd probably say just on that team of 2004, Ashley Cole was left back at that
time. Ashley Cole was left back, yeah.
England have got an Ashley Cole.
No.
And I would probably say Cole Walker's ahead of Gary Neville, because I think he would have been right back at that time.
Yeah, that's true.
So I think defensively, again, at heart of defence, I would say that definitely the 2004 team was better as defenders in that side. I'll take it back, because in 1998, I was sitting in the dressing room at Nancy with Aimé Jacquet sitting next to me. His son was a player at Nancy Football Club, a young lad, but not, he didn't make a professional, but he was in the, you know, through the academy. And I sat there talking to him, and he was telling me about the French team and how he saw it. And they'd been beaten by Germany 4-1, I think it was 4-1, about 4 months before the World Cup in France. And he was getting a lot of stick. L'Equipe, like they always do, as James will know, will go after every manager. And Aimé Jacquet got a lot of stick around. And so it was in between that period of beaten by Germany, France going to host the World Cup in 98. And we were chatting, he was talking about the strengths of the team. And he actually said to me, and it always stuck with me, he said, we can win. I think we will win. And he said, I think we could go back to back. And I remember thinking, he's giving himself the World Cup, yeah, like laughing, and actually said back to back.
Yeah, yeah.
They went and did that. I, by the way, I don't know if I should say this on radio, I had the biggest bet I ever had on France winning the World Cup in 98.
You were allowed to then, though,
and you were allowed to bet then. And it was an international that I couldn't have any influence on, but I was so convinced that France could win it, because I remember thinking, played against Zidane, again, it was a Bordeaux in 98. I'm sorry, I'm going to drop a few names in here.
Yeah, yeah.
And I played against Dugarin and a few others. Henry was, I played against Monaco. I kept thinking, there's a lot of good players in this French team, and so we're emerging. And remember thinking that. And it struck me this week that, and I've said this before, I really feel this England are close to going back to back. I'm not even thinking the Euros next year. I'm thinking they could go back to back tournaments. Now, that's a big stretch. I do think there's an element of me, have they got the manager? Can Gareth lift his standard as a manager to take them to heights that I get excited when I watch the England team? Play Republic of Ireland, I get excited. I look at them and think, wow. Standout feature for me on what day was it? Tuesday?
Tuesday.
On Tuesday night, second half performance.
Mm.
I've seen England play lots of very good first halves and not been the same in the second half. And that happened against Italy, and it happened against Croatia in the semi-final. The semi-final of the World Cup in 2018, England's first half was a team that should have got to the final.
Yeah.
Their second half was the reason why they can't win it. And I think that's what struck me, that their second half performance, when they went 1-0 down, they get back to 1-1, and then the second half was literally steamrolling the Italians. And that struck me. And I think there's loads and loads of things to come out. And maybe it's an exaggeration. I hand on heart, I really think it would be amazing if they didn't win something with the amount of quality in their forward areas. It's just whether, I think this is going to be the big challenge for Gareth, because there's one thing, look, we all know, we've just watched the Rugby World Cup and we're watching the second half and late things that happen in games, Fergie time, if you like, that's instrumental to getting the results to get you over the line. You have to have that. Does Gareth have Gareth time? Does he? Because at the moment, I would have said no, but I think it's a real valid point.
Johnny Northcroft wrote after this game that he thought Gareth Southgate showed he can think quick on his feet to outwit Spalletti. Do you think we're seeing any sort of evolution in Gareth Southgate's tactical approach? And maybe, as Tony's alluded to, that's been a criticism in the past. He's not been able to think quick enough in mid-game to change the direction of the game. Do you think we're seeing any evidence of that changing?
Well, I think perhaps the as you say, the one question that I think people will still have is that in-game tactical, you know, the sort of that very high level tactical management of whether you can really change the flow of a game as it's happening on the very biggest stages. I think I'm not quite sure Southgate has proven that yet. But what I would say, and coming back to the comparison again with the 2004 team, yes, you can go through the 2004 team and, you know, player by player and say maybe the 2004 team was a bit better. I mean, it's, I don't think there's much in it, to be honest, but, you know, maybe the 2004 team had more quality. But I think two things. 2004, obviously, was Sven's second major tournament, and this is Southgate's fourth. Obviously, things can go stale, but actually, I think in this case, it's a good thing. It's a plus that this team has been together for a long time. And I also look at this England team and I think this Southgate, you know, whatever his, you know, people like to talk about his limitations, but I think Southgate has found a balance with this England team. I don't look at this England team and think, oh, I'm not sure about that. You know, is so-and-so in the right role? I think with the 2004 team, however much talent they had, I think there were always questions about there were always slight imbalances, weren't there? You know, I'm not quite convinced that Sven-Göran Eriksson ever quite found a system that felt really balanced and felt really like the perfect arrangement of the talent that he had. To me, could be wrong. It could, you know, it may prove otherwise, but I just feel that this 4-2-3-1 that England have now hit on, I mean, it's not necessarily a particularly imaginative or funky system, but to me it just feels really balanced. I don't look at it and sort of think, oh, I'm not sure about, you know, so and so in this role. Obviously there are positions where England are a little bit weaker than some other teams, but not many. I'm broadly like Martin. I would say I'm broadly positive and optimistic about England's chances. Obviously, that doesn't mean they're going to win it, but I think you also have to look at the overall context. If you look at, ask yourself, who are the teams right now in Europe that really look like they could win Euro 2024? There are a lot of teams that, you know, would usually rank among the kind of main contenders that, to me, I just can't see winning it. I can't see...
Which teams?
I can't see Italy winning it, to be honest.
Might not make it,
yeah.
Germany.
Yeah. Obviously, I suppose you can't really rule them out with home advantage and the Julian Nagelsmann effect, but it's just so, so hard to see a team that's been in such mediocre form for years. Going back 5 or 6 years now, it's hard to see Germany winning this tournament for me. Can't see Holland winning it.
Spain,
I think, have to be considered contenders and have to be respected, given that they won the last Nations League. But I think if you look at Spain's front three, which will probably be Ferran Torres, Morata, one of Oyarzabal or Ansu or someone like that on the left, you'd take England's front three every time over that front three, wouldn't you?
Yeah. The French would always still be.
The French, of course. I think they are the main ones for me. Yeah.
We missed out Scotland there too, obviously.
But with Gareth and the change in the game and everything, I think that is the next step. And it's not about reacting. I know what Johnny was saying the other night, but it's actually, I always think with Gareth, it's not so much about reacting. It's about making the change first, about making that attacking move first. If you look at a lot of what goes wrong with England, it's that you're in a second half period and you're thinking, right, they're going to change. We need to do something to put their manager on the back foot. Yeah, absolutely. Well, they're going to do something to put us on the back foot. We've got to put them on the back foot. Change, you know, make that change now. Make that introduction of whether it's Jack Grealish or Phil Foden, or make that change now. Give them something to think about. And we sort of carry on and we carry on. And it happened with Italy as well in the European Championship final. And then Mancini makes a change, and then suddenly we're reacting to what they're doing rather than giving them the problem. And I think it's that last little bit of, I don't know whether it's what you'd call that, whether you'd call it tactical nous or whether you just call it having the confidence to be the one that is bolder first, basically, you know?
And they have so many weapons
and
so many options to do that,
you know?
A couple of the weaknesses. Then you've pointed out Calvin Phillips' sort of situation a number of occasions now, and this is probably the biggest example yet of sort of the ring rust showing. Mm. He's lucky to stay on the pitch. What does it mean, you know, as a former player, Tony, to when you're not playing football regularly? Hmm. How does it affect you?
Happened for me when I was at Celtic. I didn't start well, wasn't playing well. Liam Brady left me out. Scored 6 goals in 7 games for Republic of Ireland. But the big but, and this is where probably Martin's coming from, is that you're playing a lot of games in a short time in a tournament. Now, getting someone through one game on adrenaline, you know, that can be quite easy. But if you're going to go game after game in a short space of time, what would Calvin Phillips be like if he hardly plays all season, gets to the group phase, plays the first game, and, OK, England might only need him for 2 games out of 3 because they might qualify from that group. But I think the short period of time and then expecting performance after performance in like 6-7 games, I think would be a tough call to get right. I like him, and I get what James is saying with the setup, and I think that's spot on. We had Mick McCarthy and Kevin Moran at centre half. David O'Leary was playing at Arsenal, and David reminded me that they both played for Millwall and Blackburn, and he played for Arsenal. Okay, that was Jack Charlton's choice, but and he was stubborn about it. He was really stubborn. Liam Brady got left out of our team, you know, because he was stubborn of what he wanted. Now, I get it. I think there is a sense of loyalty from Gareth, and he really believes there are certain positions that needed to be sewed up and not necessarily be... I mean, I was listening to Danny Murphy in midweek and his commentary on Rico Lewis, and should he be in? Well, yeah, but, you know, there's always one or two. I can maybe John Barnes and Chris Waddle, you know, with England being questioned to be being in the team. Chris Waddle was playing the best club football in his career at that time when he was getting boos by Wembley by England fans. So I think that's the genius of the manager. You know, I'll always fall back onto that because I do think there's master strokes. And as we alluded to earlier, that sometimes reacting first to even if you're in a winning position, instead of waiting and then seeing it and go, oh no, now what do we do? The Croatia game, I've watched that probably 3 times. I remember thinking, all they've done is their wide men, they've switched and made England's fullbacks be pushed back. Mm. And it just changed the whole outcome of the scenario of the game. And that's why England lost it.
Just one other kind of perceived weakness is Harry Maguire. For the same reason, he's not playing enough football. And that's always been the reason that everyone is putting forward. You've written for the Times newsletter this week, kind of boring into the data of his performances. Actually, what did you find about?
It's not even so much the data. It's quite hard. We actually had a question into the readers' inbox about, you know, can you sort of show with data Harry Maguire's effect on England? And it's actually quite hard to do that simply because there's a very limited sample without Harry Maguire. He's played an awful lot of the kind of serious matches. Harry Maguire, I think, I mean, what's interesting about Harry Maguire's career is when he really emerged and sort of was popular, he was really quite an adventurous, progressive centre-back. And you'll remember at like the 2018 Absolutely. World Cup, for example, he would drive past players. You know, he would almost play as an auxiliary attacker at times. Also a very good passer of the ball. Just, you know, I mean, not to kind of be really boring about the data, but he ranked very highly in, you know, things like progressive passes, progressive carries, which, you know, when you carry the ball or pass the ball forward 10 yards. And his abilities in all those areas really have gradually declined, whether that's because of, you know, he's being asked to play a different type of football at Manchester United, whether it's because he's also lost a bit of confidence. But certainly he doesn't quite offer the things that he used to offer in that regard. And the other thing about Harry Maguire is Harry Maguire has a bit of a technical weakness in build-up, which is that it's quite a sort of particular thing, but when the ball comes across him from the right, and obviously Harry Maguire usually plays on the left, although we did see him play on the right a couple of games ago, possibly the one against Ukraine, I think, when he played on the right and Gay played on the left. Can't remember exactly, but he usually plays on the left. And when the ball comes across him from the right, Harry Maguire tends to take his first touch with the outside of his right foot rather than taking it on his left. And that obviously quite often has the effect of sort of closing off, you know, obviously closes off the pass to the left back. It closes off a lot of the pitch. And we really saw this Particularly, I think you can actually see it if you pick pretty much any England game, you'll find an example of it, I guarantee. But we saw it particularly in the recent game against Scotland. Obviously, that was a very particular match when the crowd were really on Maguire's back. But there were a lot of moments when the ball was passed to Maguire from the right, and he really slowed the play down just because it took him. You know, he took that first touch.
He often then wants to play a pass to midfielders under pressure.
Yes, that, or it just has to go back to whoever's playing right centre back. And I think England obviously have some options in that position. So I think it looks like at the moment Mark Gay seems to me to be uppermost in Southgate's thinking. Gay, of course, is also right-footed, but he does seem a little bit more comfortable taking the ball on his left and playing with a slightly more open body position. And in the game against in his recent games, he played a couple of really nice passes where he was, just by receiving the ball in a more open way, he was able to find Rice or Bellingham between the lines. Look, there are a lot of good reasons why Southgate trusts Maguire, and I think whatever you think about Maguire, you have to say Maguire's played three major tournaments for England and he's been pretty solid performer in those major tournaments. And And you can't underestimate as well the intangibles, cohesion, the sort of Maguire's kind of status in the squad, his sort of
leadership, all that
leadership, thing, the sort of the consistency of having him there. But and frankly, I suspect that Maguire will be a starter at the Euros. But I just think he's technically become a more limited player, and I think it might be, if I were in Southgate's shoes, it might be worth having a real look at Mark Gay over these next four games.
We've fleeted over Jude Bellingham, but my God, we can't stop. Like, every time there's an England game, he just steals the show. It's won a penalty, assist for, well, was it an assist? I suppose it was, yes. It was, but he kind of did everything. He won the won the ball and he's on the edge of his own box. Searing run, laid it off to Rashford, then another run to kind of drag the defenders away. He's just a force of nature, isn't he, Martin?
He's a game-changing player. He's potentially a tournament-changing player because he is the guy that will drag you over the line, and he seems such an old head, and all the cliches, basically, old head and young shoulders and all of that sort of stuff. But I mean, I can remember when he left Birmingham and they retired his number. Yeah. I think he'd only played about 20 odd games for them or whatever. I can remember writing a couple of paragraphs in a column taking the mickey out of it, and how it'd get you, like, it was Paolo Maldini or something. He played 25 games or whatever. Looking back, they knew more than I did. They'd obviously seen him and went, right, this is Paolo Maldini, but he's just for 25 matches. an incredible player, absolutely incredible player. And as I say, that feeling in 1990, and it's probably misplaced because Maradona was still going in 1990 and still going for another 4 years, but it was on the wane. And when you watched Paul Gascoigne in that tournament, you just thought, no one else has got anyone like this. No one else has got a player like this. And that's what you see with Jude Bellingham. I know we were talking about this earlier, Gregor, there's prettier players and there's guys that will do the spectacular and everything. I'm not sure there's too many guys out there that can change a match the way that Jude Bellingham changes it, and the way that England took that game away from Italy in the second half. I mean, two breakaways that were converted with such confidence. And that, I think, is what he's also brought to the team. He's brought a feeling of confidence to that team where good players look around. You guys must know it. You look around, you think, oh, we've got so-and-so. Well, we've got this guy in the team today. This will be all right. He can get us out of trouble. If we're in trouble, this guy can get us out of trouble. That's what you'd think if you were a teammate of Jude Bellingham's. That's what you'd think when you saw that starting lineup, like, we've got him.
We'll all remember his number, won't we, at Birmingham? We all know the story.
Yeah,
the 22, the 10, the 8 and the 4.
Yeah, that's right.
A mixture of three players.
Yeah.
It was quite weird because I've listened a lot this week, and you know, references. You always get a.
He's been spoken of as the best, one of the, you know, yeah, the best player in the world.
Well, he's,
now,
you know, someone said to me the other day, you know, I was on radio talking about it, someone said to me, well, he's, you know, if he can reach that other level. And I went, how about if he just stayed as consistent as he is now? You know, laughing, because I'm thinking, really? Yeah. He's been brilliant. It's just, that'll do, you know, laughing. But I also felt, and of course I had the Gazza reference, and you can reference loads of players that have qualities. And I said to one of our bosses, I was chatting to him yesterday, and I just said, do you know what? You know the Gerard Lampard argument, they couldn't play together? I said, well, they're playing as one person now because he can do both what they did.
Absolutely.
That's a testament to how good he's been. He can be both of them. He can be Lampard and drive forward, get goals, get on the end of chances, score goals. He can be that player that moves the ball around, you know, the driving force of what Gerard. I think he's them two in one.
But also, I quite like the fact that Bellingham has really emerged this season as number 10.
Yeah,
and you know, obviously,
yeah,
he's a player who, you know, he's so brilliant and so multifaceted that yes, you know, he could play as the eight, or you know, and in future he may, you know, perhaps he'll develop into an even more rounded player. But just for now, I really like, and I think it's positive for England that he has really emerged as the number 10, because what that gives England is just complete role clarity in that midfield. You know that Phillips, or whoever it is the six, Declan Rice is the eight, and Bellingham is the 10. And I think international tournaments are often won by, you know,
the
systems
number.
that tend to be quite simple, but that are very clear and effective. It's essentially, you know, remember at France, at the last World Cup, Conte was the six, Pogba was the eight in a more disciplined role than he usually played, and Griezmann was the 10. Complete clarity. And I think That's what Bellingham's emergence as the 10 gives England.
Yeah, and going back to that 2004 point you were making, James, about Eriksen, you know, there wasn't the same clarity. There was, but it wasn't a good clarity. I know exactly the point you're making, because we had Beckham, Gerrard, Lampard and Scholes, and he was trying to play them as a pretty much a conventional four, so that Beckham stayed right and Scholes stayed left. And Lampard and Gerrard were meant to operate as the Pistons, like Vieira and Petit operated for Arsenal, but they didn't do it. And everyone thinks it was because they kept charging up the field. It was the exact opposite problem. They were both too disciplined. They were both too scared of letting a gap in. So they ended up both staying back. And we ended up like with our two best forward players both looking at each other going, well, do I go or do... And what he had to do was make a call in that 2004 tournament to bring Hargreaves in, and the guy that had to go, and he was going to be the last guy to go, but of that four of midfield, he was the least impactful in that tournament, was Beckham. He was the one, that was the tournament where you couldn't quite work out what was wrong with him, because he wasn't injured or anything like that, but he wasn't quite at his best in the 2004 tournament, helped get us there. And that was the change that had to be made to accommodate Scholes, who's a generational talent that ended up retiring from international football because he kept being played on the left. And to make sure that Gerrard and Lampard could both go on. And it was a great shame. I've always thought that was the great missed opportunity. And that is why, as you say, it's so important that we've actually got a team that makes sense at the moment, because England should have won the 2004 European Championships. I have no doubt about that, that there was an England team there that was the best team in Europe.
You can look at history and you can go through quite a number of teams and you can say, you know, Zidane in 98 was the 10 that made massive differences. You know, you can look at players of that quality. You can go to Maradona in 86.
Yeah.
You know, it was all about, he was such a wonderful player. How do we make the rest of the team fit into him but still be a really good side and have different qualities? That's happened numerous times.
It feels funny, though. We spoke about this earlier, Martin and I. You know, just talking about him in the same breath, Bellingham, in the same breath as players of that quality, or even some of the other best players in the world just now. But as Martin said, he's not. It's about his impact on games. There's very few players on the planet just now who impact every single game they play in. Mm.
Greg,
quite
profoundly. We're not talking about a young lad that's come through the scene and come from the lower leagues, and you know he was at Birmingham, but he ended up playing for a big club called Borussia Dortmund in Germany, and then, by the way, then had a big move to Real Madrid. Mm. He's playing for Real Madrid. Real Madrid have invested over 100 million. They obviously thought we are getting the best player, midfield player in the world. For this price, we have to take that deal. You know, and he talks about afterwards, I'd want to play the rest of my career at Real Madrid. You know, I want to play 15 years at this club. His mentality has stuck out. The way he reacts, the way he interviews, the way he plays. I don't see a... You know, we talked about Gazza, and Gazza had a reckless side in him.
Yeah, totally.
You know, and that was why Gazza wasn't the best player on the planet.
Yeah.
Because there was a reckless side to Gazza. Mm. And I don't see that in Bellingham. Hopefully... that stays that way. But I do see a player who's playing for Real Madrid. Let's not forget that. He's not playing for, you know, a club mid-table somewhere who rocks up at England and has been brilliant. He's been brilliant for Dortmund. Obviously, Birmingham. Didn't play there very long, but he was brilliant for them. Mm. He's played brilliant for England. He's been brilliant for Real Madrid. Mm. It's hard to find a little bit of a weakness in there somewhere.
And he's not even at the age yet, I don't think, that... I sat down with Arsene Wenger a couple of years ago, and he was talking about all the research that he has done with FIFA into age groups and you know what things happen at what age. And he talks about separation points, ages, average ages at which there are separation points, where a truly gifted player just leaves the peers behind or whatever. And he says, you know, he'd been in football obviously all his life. He said, and You can get a bunch of 15 or 16 year olds. He said, and I couldn't tell you who's going to make it out of this group of 15 or 16 year olds. But 18, there's a separation where you can begin to say, yeah, that guy's a player and that guy hasn't quite got it. The final stage, the one that he said is the most important stage of separation, happens at 22. Right. He said, and that's when we look at all of our data and our records, he said, that's when the sort of the Messi-Ronaldo type separation occurs. Those players that are going to be the greatest of their generation, it's at 22 that they suddenly just disappear into the stratosphere compared to their contemporaries. Bellingham's not at that stage yet. He's not actually at the stage where according to FIFA's numbers, and he actually leaves everybody behind. And, you know, maybe he's just an early developer and he's left everyone behind a bit earlier.
He's always been an early developer.
Yeah, but he hasn't reached the stage, according to Wenger, where you just disappear. You look around and there's no one else around you all of a sudden.
Okay, well, one player who has reached that age is Jadon Sancho, who's 23, and so we'll be speaking about him after the break. Still loads more to come. If you're enjoying the podcast, make sure you're subscribed. Just go to thetimes.co.uk/thegame for the latest subscription offer.
The train is now approaching junction at platform.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. James Gerbrandt, Tony Cascarino, Martin Samuel, joining me, Gregor Robertson here. Jadon Sancho. The sad reality of Jadon Sancho's Manchester United XL is the headline in today's Times of Paul Hurst's piece. The winger went from a £73 million sensation to a pariah. How did it happen, he asks. Some really fascinating insight and detail in this piece about the sort of, as it says in the headline, the reality of the situation Jadon Sancho now finds himself in. He's not allowed in any part of the first team building at Manchester United's training ground, including the canteen, so his meals are carried to him in the academy facility in a black takeaway box with a United badge on it and a plastic lid.
That's a nice touch.
He trains on the academy pitches away from the rest of the youngsters, with one coach for company. And because of safeguarding rules, the building contains minors, Sancho must change on his own and lock the door behind him before removing his clothes. So this is a remarkable fall from grace for a player who, let's not forget, started in the quarterfinal in the last Euros against Ukraine and missed one of the penalties in the final. So, you know, was an important player for Gareth Southgate. And, you know, the idea of him making England's squad for the next Euros is virtually zero. How has this happened?
Well, this story has been pretty astonishing for quite a long while, where, look, you fall out, you have disagreements, things are said, sometimes things, as we see with social media, are written, and then you have the manager who's trying to change the dynamics of the football club that's been failing, and standards haven't been reached. And somewhere along the line, there's always stuff you don't know. You know, what has actually happened? Have they had a face-to-face? Has things been said in that face-to-face where Ten Hag has gone, you know, we're hearing in recent weeks, there's no way out of this, that I've got to move him on. There's been rumours of him going. I found it difficult from Sancho's side to try and get why a young man would make that comment about being left out. If I'm thinking of me, I would have gone and saw the manager. If he had said something I didn't believe was true, I would have gone and knocked on his door. Now, that hasn't happened. It was done by a social media post, and it's just escalated.
And he's refusing to apologise.
Yeah, and he's refusing. But I would have. To me, it's like simple. You don't need your agent. You don't need to speak to anybody else. You go and knock on the guy, and if he's dishonest, you can look him in the eye and you say, well, what you said there is not true. And he will know, Ten Hag. So obviously, there's a massive breakdown between the two of them that, for a young man who's seemingly, you know, had other issues off the field, and, you know, I don't get what benefit Ten Hag would have by just ditching him and discarding him. I know managers who have done that. We all know managers have just gone, you can go and train with the kids. Don't want you nowhere near me. I never have been put in that position, but I've seen players who have, and managers have been brutal to them. I remember the story of George Graham, what he was like to a lad called Dean Neal at Millwall. You know, the way he basically left him out a year because he wouldn't sign a new deal at Millwall. You know, the guy was top goal scorer. George Graham wanted him to sign a new deal. He refused to sign, left him out completely. Dean Neal was playing non-league a year after. Didn't play any football at all. Now, some managers go a bit too far. So it's a really tough one to dissect for me on where it all lies. I just wish Sancho owned it a bit more. And I think that going back to the basics things in life of sit down and talk to someone, tell him how you feel, why he wasn't happy with that particular statement the manager made. From there, it feels like I'm speaking about a lot of stuff. I don't really know the answers. All I know is there must have been one hell of a breakdown.
12 goals and 6 assists in 82 appearances for Manchester United after 114 goals in 137 matches for Dortmund. You've been a kind of champion.
Goals and assists, I assume.
Goals and assists, yeah. You've been a bit of a champion of Sancho, even when he was playing over there. You thought over in Germany, you thought perhaps he's not getting the kind of the recognition or the profile he deserves. And also, you've written quite recently about the fact that without the kind of pioneering, trailblazing Jadon Sancho, who went left Manchester City for Borussia Dortmund, we might not see the Jude Bellingham we see today. So this is a hugely sad situation for a player of that quality and that talent.
I think it is really sad, yeah. I mean, I thought Jadon Sancho was a hugely exciting player when he was at Borussia Dortmund. And I think with players, with these kind of situations, you can always get a bit of, you know, revisionism and people sort of going, oh, he wasn't really that good. But you know, Sancho was so, you know, not even on sort of, you know, kind of just on sheer goals and assists, you know, the bread and butter of an attacker. Sancho was an exceptionally good player for Dortmund. I think, you know, in Sancho's 3 first team seasons at Dortmund, across that 3-year span, there were only 2 players in Europe who had more assists, and that was Lionel Messi and Thomas Müller. I mean, this was a guy who was, you know, who was operating at a really, really high level. And, you know, obviously, there are different types of good player. There are some good players who are just able to impose their excellence on any system. And there are some players who are maybe a little bit less resilient, maybe a little bit less versatile, and, you know, who are excellent in a very particular system and find it more difficult to sort of adapt. And maybe Sancho has proven to be, you know, one of those in the latter category. But I still think it's a hugely sad situation. And you know, I do think it was probably, you know, who knows, without Sancho moving to Borussia Dortmund and being such a success, would Dortmund have taken that punt on Jude Bellingham, or would Jude Bellingham's representatives have been as confident in?
Well, there've been so many players, not only Jude Bellingham, who followed suit. Absolutely. And saw an opportunity to get, you know, first team action in a major European league.
It's disappointing as well what's happened, because obviously, you know, Sancho essentially hasn't really done it at Manchester United. I think, you know, I would argue there have been matches and moments and matches where I think he's played well, but, you know, clearly overall you have to say he hasn't really done it. But I think also he had, what's disappointing about this particular situation at the moment is that Sancho actually had a chance to establish himself in the team. Obviously with Antony's situation, there also have been suggestions that Sancho has now sort of sees himself as a left winger and doesn't really like playing on the right. To me, that feels, I would like to know more about that, but to me that feels strange, given that when he was at Dortmund, it was pretty much 50-50. He played both, and he played a lot of minutes in both and was successful in both roles. So I'd be interested to know where the kind of apparent reluctance to play on the right comes from, or where his own conception that that's not his best role comes from. Obviously, it's, you know, the opportunity at Manchester United, if he was not in this situation with Ten Hag, would seem to be on the right. And I think it would have been, with what has happened with Antony, I think he would have had a chance to, you know. I think so much of it as well, and I think this is true of so many players, like, you know, I mean, also looking at players like Donny van der Beek, I think so much of it as well. Some players just need rhythm. Some players just need consistent minutes. And Sancho played so regularly at Borussia Dortmund. And I think so much of what made him excellent was, you know, just building up that rhythm, constantly exchanging and interacting with, you know, the players around him, building up those kind of familiar patterns. And I think, you know,
not many players have done that at Manchester United. Recently,
not many
basically.
Players have done that at Manchester United, no, and I think, no. You know, it would be. I think we'd all know a lot more about Jadon Sancho, and you know, we'd be kind of closer to sort of understanding the enigma if he really had a run of consistent minutes in the first team. I'm not blaming Ten Hag for not giving him minutes, or, you know, arguably he hasn't done enough to deserve that. But I think the particular sadness of what's happened this season, or one of the great shames, is that I think Sancho, in a parallel universe where he wasn't having this dispute with Ten Hag, would have had an opportunity to maybe play regular minutes in this team and, you know, kind of get his career back on track a little bit. And obviously that's not happening.
Here's what I don't understand. So agents have, you know, it's very easy for an agent, if all you actually ever do is negotiate a new contract or set someone up with a boot deal with a boot manufacturer or whatever. This is where the agent should be earning his money. This is where, as a mediator in a situation like this. Equally, this burgeoning recruitment department that we always hear about at Manchester United, all these many directors of football that every single club has got now, directors of football, head of recruitment, that. Where are all these people in the middle of this? Where are all these people saying, right, okay, this needs mediating between the player and the manager? I find it unfathomable that you have got an asset to the football club that is measured in tens of millions, 75 million did they pay for him? And no one is is really inserting themselves in the middle of this and trying to actually sort it out. Because at the moment, what is playing, I can't even see that it's still a story when people say, oh, Sancho will be sold in the January transfer. And you go, well, of course he'll be sold in the January transfer. Ten Hag wanted him to go to Saudi Arabia permanently this summer. That's how bad the situation was by the time we got to the end of the last transfer window, because the Saudi Arabia deal broke down because Manchester United, and by Manchester United you've got to believe Ten Hag, wanted to make it permanent, and the Saudi Arabians only wanted to make it a loan deal. And it was turned down because Ten Hag's thought was, I just want him out. So that is a situation that has been irretrievable since when was the transfer window? 1st or 2nd of September?
Yeah.
Where are the club in this? Where is his agent in this, in trying to find some way forward? I don't get it.
Well, one of the greatest players in the world we've seen the last two decades was obviously Ronaldo. Mm. And the way that he was out the club,
yeah,
pretty dramatically. And you could never accuse Ronaldo of being unprofessional.
No.
I mean, no. It just doesn't go hand in hand. This guy has never done... Okay, he's got an ego and he's got this side of him that it is all about Ronaldo, but that's made him the great player. Mm. And I found at the time, I remember thinking, oh, Ten Hag, you're taking on one of the greatest players that's ever played and you're making him look like a problem at your football club.
But he's spoken a lot about the need to change the culture and to impose sort of more discipline. So I suppose he's seeing that as
So you saying Ronaldo really is... ill-disciplined.
No, what I'm saying is any player who's ageing and their powers are on the wane doesn't like to see their value diminished a little bit.
Can I just make one quick... Sorry, James, I just want to make this, because there's a point that's always stuck with me on him, is that maybe he returned to Man United and gone, this club has gone miles backward.
Mm. Okay? So did he, though.
I think he was... Look, he was still an asset to Manchester United, and I don't think he was being ill-disciplined in any way. I think what he done was spoke a few home truths about where the club had gone and the direction. Ten Hag didn't like it and probably had a face-to-face with Ronaldo. And Ronaldo said a few things to him as well that he did on his own coaching or something. So I find it a bit difficult to accept that Ronaldo was this bad pro at Man United, but everywhere else he was an incredible pro.
I still think... you have a little bit of the shadow of Sir Alex Ferguson at play here, because Manchester United obviously had this incredibly dynastically successful period under a manager where it was his way or the highway. And there are so many examples of that. And obviously, you know, Beckham talks about it in his documentary. There were ones that Fergie regretted, like Jaap Stam as well, where he decided that he just had to go. And essentially United haven't really had a really successful manager since then. Obviously, no. You can make your arguments about, but really they haven't got it right since then. And I think part of what Ten Hag is doing, and part of why generally I think I'm right in saying Ten Hag remained pretty popular last season, even though he showed Ronaldo the door. I think part of it is because you have this unignorable precedent of Sir Alex Ferguson and the way he operated, and I don't know if Ten Hag is consciously trying to kind of live up to that, or whether it's just, you know, the kind of institutional culture of the place. I don't quite know how it works, but you know, there are other ways of doing things. I mean, look at, you know, I mean, it's different, completely different example, but, you know, you look at how Mikel Arteta, you know, sat down with Granit Xhaka, for example, you know, when Xhaka was sort of, you know, seemingly on his way out and persona non grata. And, you know, Arteta is in some ways quite an old school guy as well, but he was able to sort of...
But he didn't do it with Aubameyang.
No, true.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. I think it's one of those things where you pick and choose who's worth saving. I've always thought this, that high maintenance pest part of it, you know, a high maintenance pest is worth it whilst they're absolutely delivering. Everywhere Cristiano Ronaldo went, he absolutely delivered. So all of the high maintenance stuff, Steve Bruce tells a story about Ferguson. And so when they, whenever they were on club duty, Steve said that they had to wear the club blazer.
I know this story.
You know this story. Yeah. It's a great story. So they had to wear the club blazer. The club blazer had this giant, old-fashioned Manchester United crest on it. It was like the size of the lapel. It was huge, and everyone hated it. Absolutely everyone hated it. But whenever you went anywhere, you know. So they've gone to the... They've won the league, and they've gone to this town hall reception, and the edict has come out. It's club tie, club blazer, and all the boys are like absolutely furious or whatever. He said, and we've turned up. He said, and we're all there, like, look, can you believe this? You know this. He said, and Cantona's walked in. He said, and he's got a pair of ripped jeans on. He said, he's got this shirt untucked, no socks, thong sandals. And he said, and we're all looking at him, going, no. He said, the boss is over there, he's not said a word. He said, so I'm the captain. He said, and everyone's coming up to me going, you can have a word. You can, so he said, I'm like shuffling a little bit closer to him, a little bit closer to him. I go, go on, tell him. He said, and in the end, I've got next to him. I said, boss, a few of the lads are just wondering, you know, if you've seen our Eric's come dressed tonight, you know. Fergie's looked at Cantona, he's looked at Steve, he said, if you can tell them, if they can do what he does for us, they can come dressed as Joseph and in Technicolor dream coat as well. And that is the high maintenance dressing.
Yeah.
You know, if Eric Cantona wasn't doing it, the high maintenance and the pest part of it would outweigh, you know, that would have been him out of the club.
Biggest myth in the world, okay? Sir Alex Ferguson didn't sort of choose who he decided to have arguments with or not. He appeased Roy Keane for a number of years when he was his best player.
Yeah.
He was his best player, was never going to upset Roy. There was loads. I had enough Man United friends who, you know, from the Ireland team, and Keane was appeased for a long time until he weren't his best player. Then he was shown the hard door out immediately. So, you know, Fergie was brilliant at that, where he could manage a star and he could make different demands of certain players. That's a talent. That's managing talent. And I just think Fergie was just so, so strong in that department.
I think Eric Ten Hag's biggest problem is, I'm trying to think of anyone in that Manchester United team at the moment that you would turn a blind eye to. I don't think there's any of them at the moment are playing well enough to not be disposable. That could have been anybody at the moment, couldn't it? I mean, who would you look in that Manchester United team at right now and go, well, you know, he could turn up dressed in sandals and he could turn up. There's not too many, is there? You know.
No. Well, it'd be fascinating to see how Jadon Sancho can reinvigorate his career, if he can, and where. So, on to the Premier League 3 p.m. blackout now. Well, the Premier League has no plans to ditch the 3 p.m. blackout, but it seems to be backed into the corner. It's the very last tranche of games from 2025 that will not be shown live on TV. From 200 up to 270 games from 380 per season will all be shown live now. And so we just thought it'd be worth asking, can the 3 p.m. blackout survive? And if it matters, Martin, what do you think?
Look, it doesn't greatly matter to me, but, I'm not trying to run a League Two football club. I mean, they'll tell you how much it will matter. When we were chatting about this earlier, one of the things that Gregor mentioned, actually, was that we are moving towards this, you know, like the Champions League coverage where there's a goal show immediately after the final whistle. I think that will almost be a bigger distraction. When Gregor mentioned it, I thought, yeah, he's right. That will be the bigger distraction if there's something like that, more than... Because if you're looking at, there's 100 and... So what are we talking about? 110 matches that won't be live on television?
Yes.
So if you look at the sort of matches that they will be, I don't think if you are a fan of Tranmere Rovers you're not going to go to Tranmere because Bournemouth versus Crystal Palace is on the box or whatever. I really don't. So I don't think that the 3 p.m. kick-off, I think there's a lot of games that you could put on at 3 o'clock that wouldn't necessarily affect the lower divisions at all. It's not like they're going to say, oh, we'll have Liverpool and Manchester United kicking off at 3 o'clock. However, if you're having goal shows and more packages and that sort of thing, that whole idea that, shall I go to Tranmere or shall I just sit here and watch, you know, watch the 12:30, then watch the highlights package at this, that could be a bigger problem. I do think we are moving, and I sat there and I worked it out the other day. You could pretty much have a kickoff every 2 hours, from 12 o'clock to 8 o'clock at night on a Saturday, and then 12 o'clock to 8 o'clock at night on a Sunday, and that's your 10 Premier League matches. And so you could actually have every single game live on the television if you wanted.
So it's almost like having, you're right, the 3 p.m. kickoff in isolation would not dissuade, as you say, fans of lower league clubs from going to going to watch the local team. But if you have wall-to-wall coverage throughout every Saturday and Sunday, that might. And particularly if you're a young football fan getting into football and you've got the choice between watching 4 or 5 games in one day on the TV or going along to watch your local non-league club, it might change someone's mind, Tony.
Yeah, I'm thinking about, do I need to get a solicitor, because I'm not sure my missus will go along. Oh dear, can there be more football?
Well, that's another fair point. Is there, how much is too much football?
That's what I'm saying, but I would have thought 10 years ago that I know that's coming. I think we all know that. That's pretty much American sport. We have so much more American owners that, you know, they play, you go in an airport and you're sitting in the airport and you're certainly, if in America you've got game after game, you just sit at the bar and watch the game.
Yeah.
You know, that's what life is in America. So.
Certainly baseball. I mean, baseball, there is no moment of any day when baseball is not being played somewhere in America. Yeah. I mean, it's ridiculous.
They've got 4 sports, really. Yeah. If you go baseball, basketball, American football, and maybe ice hockey, it's wall-to-wall. I've sat in the airports in America a number of times and thought, I wonder if we'll ever get to this stage where you'll just sit and watch sport on 24/7. And funny enough, I visited my dad in America in mid to late 90s, and he had a channel on his TV, and it was the Cowboy Channel. Mm. And it basically was Bonanza, High Chaparral, and all these cowboy films, one after the other, 24/7 every day. And I said to him, Dad, is that what you do? Just put. He said, the westerns they've got on here, they're brilliant. And I remember thinking, surely they can't have a whole channel. And they did. Yeah. And I think we will end up with 24/7. Look, we have radio stations. You know, I work for one, 24 hours every day, sport. Yeah. You know, I don't see it getting less. I see it getting more. Mm. Will it be flooded? Probably. Will people pick and choose what they watch? Yes, I would imagine so. I've sort of got used to it, really.
Cowboy Channel. Is that Everton TV?
Yeah, Everton TV. You just go to channel whatever, and there you are, one after the other. It go from every Western of every type, and it's just... And I remember thinking, well, that's where sport is.
Mm.
That is where sport is now. We are... You know, you can watch cricket on like we've had the rugby. I mean, I call it, some days I laugh, and I do this a bit too often, but I always laugh. I say, you know when they have Super Saturday or Super Sunday and they give all these names, and I go, yeah, that's Divorce Sunday, that one.
Yeah.
Where you literally...
every single game, yeah.
I personally don't have particularly strong views on the 3 p.m. blackout, just because I can see both sides of it. But I think what's difficult is... For the UK based consumer, right, it's a lot of money because it's quite fragmented. There are games on Sky, and there are games on TNT or whatever it's called now, and there are games on Amazon. So it's quite a lot of money to subscribe to watch China. Premier League football. It's, you know, and the problem is that you have some of the games that are not currently viewable in the UK are actually quite good games, and people in, you know, other parts of the world can see them. And if you're a UK consumer and you're shelling out however many hundreds of pounds it is per year, and you can't watch whatever game it is, that's a bit annoying. I mean, is that sustainable? I'm not sure.
I think with it that in the end, all the Premier League are doing really is they're just trying to give more and more over to get more and more money, you know, which I know sounds very obvious, but I don't think people always realise what they're actually... It's all to try to stop a band of elite clubs breaking away, trying to negotiate their own television deal. They're trying to put so much money in the game all the time that Manchester United and Liverpool will not turn around and say, well, actually... We'll do our own TV, we'll do our own package and everything like that. Because, I mean, that was always Scudamore's greatest achievement, was every single year persuading the owners of Manchester United that they should be part of a collective bargaining arrangement. And he used to explain that they were the only ones that would really, really benefit. That actually, a lot of the elite clubs that might think they would benefit from it, when you looked at the Premier League's numbers, they're doing better as part of a collective bargaining deal. Even some of the bigger clubs, Chelsea and stuff, are still doing better as part of a collective bargaining deal. But Manchester United would just disappear over the horizon
if they
negotiate their own TV deal.
I mean, you boys would probably know this better than me, but I think up to a few years ago, the audience, because obviously you can't watch the Premier League games. Mm. Well, you can, but you're not on the Premier League channel. Around the world was something like 400 million, were watching.
It's astonishing.
Which are incredible numbers.
Well, if you look at this weekend, for example, you've got the Merseyside derby at 12:30, televised, which Jurgen Klopp is obviously not happy about again.
Yeah.
And the London derby, Chelsea Arsenal at 5:30, Sheffield United Manchester United at 8. So Man City Brighton you would probably pick as a 3 p.m. game. That's going to be a fascinating game. So if somebody had the opportunity to sit and watch all those games,
yeah, absolutely,
on a Saturday, it's true, the opportunity to go out, to leave the house for a bit and maybe go and watch a local game or your team. Yeah. Would be, you know, it would.
But that's also the issue, though. So Man City v Brighton is at 3 p.m.
Is it? Yeah.
And that's the issue that I was talking
about. Why shouldn't we get to watch that?
If you're a football fan, if you're a fan of Premier League football and you're paying X hundred pounds a year to watch Premier League football on TV, you might really want to watch.
Yeah.
You know, Pep Guardiola versus Roberto De Zerbi. Oh, that's a great game, right? And you can't. To me, that's the sticking point.
It's the battle between the global fan and the local fan, which is sort of still got a long way to go, I think. Anyway, Martin Samuel, Tony Cascarino, James Gearbrand, thank you very much. If you enjoyed the show, make sure you're subscribed, leave us a review, and we'll be back on Monday.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.